Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. I am Diana Isaacs, joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we are so excited today to have a very special guest, Dr. John Buse, who's going to talk to us about the Catalyst trial that he and a few of his colleagues presented at ADA. So I'm going to turn it to you, Dr. Buse, if you don't mind introducing yourself, describing a little bit about your practice for our listeners.
That actually turns out to be a great question. So I'm a professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. My practice is exclusively people with diabetes, though I'm a board-certified endocrinologist. I actually spent time as a division chief of general medicine. I think of myself as a general internist, but what one of my weaknesses is I'm really not a very good endocrinologist. I have never practiced endocrinology, just diabetes.
Well, we're so excited to have you with us today. So, if we could start, if you could provide a little bit of background about what is this Catalyst trial?
Okay. So Catalyst is a study that is in two parts. The first part is basically a screening study, where we screened 1,000 people to see how many people had hypercortisolism. And the second part will take those people who screened through, who meet sort of the criteria for being prescribed mifepristone as a treatment for hypercortisolism, to see among those people with hypercortisolism, does the mifepristone therapy improve diabetes care? And what we've reported so far at the American Diabetes Association is just the results of the screening study. The interventional study is ongoing and will be finished at the end of the year.
So tell us about this 1,000 patients. What was the criteria of the study itself? Where let's start back at the beginning here. How did you pick? Because when I read the initial abstract, it said difficult to control A1Cs greater than 7.2. And I think all of us think 7.2, you're close enough. Maybe we should let this go. So tell us some, give us some background there.
Well, in medical school or nursing school or whatever school you go to in the health arena, you hear about Cushing's disease and Cushing's syndrome. And what we classically think of is a centrally obese person with purple stria and all kinds of terrible complaints. But it turns out that there is a much larger population with hypercortisolism that generally goes unrecognized. They look pretty normal. They are not syndromic. They tend to have problems like uncontrolled hypertension, uncontrolled diabetes, problems with weight gain, that sort of thing. But the rationale for the trial was to use a very sensitive test for hypercortisolism, the 1 milligram overnight dexamethasone suppression test, where you have the patient take 1 milligram of dexamethasone at 11 p.m. and show up in the clinic to have a measurement of serum cortisol and serum dexamethasone at 8 o'clock in the morning the next day. And the cut point is a value of greater than 1.8. So the inclusion criteria of the trial, it actually was a hemoglobin A1C greater than 7.5, in the setting of rather intensively treated diabetes. So three or more agents, or insulin plus another agent, or two agents with evidence of complications, that sort of thing. So as opposed to just difficult to control diabetes, might characterize it as, challenging diabetes to care for. And we found these people, consented them, and then had them do the overnight dexamethasone suppression test.
I'm curious how it was recruiting for this study because just hearing the criteria, this fits a lot of people a lot. So I'm just kind of curious the overall, like how it was recruiting.
What I would say about it was, it's interesting. It's probably a quarter of the people with diabetes in the United States might qualify for this study. We don't have an exact way of determining it, but it's a pretty common phenotype. And if you just think of the people that, you know, you've been doing your best to manage their diabetes and their hypertension, and you're, you know, just piling on medicines and it just never works out, and you're wondering in the back of your head whether the patient's actually taking their medications. And, you know, generally when you're talking to the patients, you sort of feel bad about not making the progress that you want. When we approach these patients, there were some who decided not to have the test because it did involve taking a medication. It did involve having to make another trip back to the clinic. But most people were willing to give it a go. And it wasn't hard to find people who qualified.
I'm curious, were this done mostly in endocrine clinics, or did it also include primary care?
It was mostly in endocrine clinics. And we did that on purpose because we wanted to recruit people had made a serious effort to control their diabetes. Now, frankly, in our center, for instance, we're in a big building. The endocrine clinic is one of the clinics. So we did recruit patients from primary care clinics and nephrology clinics and cardiology clinics. So we at least went to a lot of other places, but many of these were private practice endocrine kind of settings.
Okay, so we screen 1,000 people. A1C is greater than 7, 1 insulin balance and other medication, 7.5, right? 7.5. We these people have agreed to do this test, which isn't very difficult. You know, you swallow that one pill, and you go straight to bed. That's how we teach it here. Go straight to bed. Take that pill as you put your head on the pillow. You get up the next morning. You go get your blood drawn. Of those 1,000 people who screened positive with a 1.8, how many people screened positive?
Well, first, before I give you the answer, I want the audience to think for a minute, what do they think in their wildest dreams the proportion would be? You know, there are prior studies that suggested that it was probably in the single digits, you know, 3 to 8%. And there are other studies that it's even been, you know, closer to a third. But what we found about 25% or 1 in 4 people that we screened actually did have evidence of hypercortisolism.
Wow, that is a lot. I mean, were you surprised with these results?
So when we were talking about doing the study and we asked the steering committee about, you know, a dozen people like me who have largely diabetes-focused practices or big diabetes practice in the context of an endocrine clinic, and no one guessed higher than 8%, if my recollection is correct. So we were stunned.
Wow. I'm stunned. I mean, I'm stunned.
Yeah. So, you know, I might point out that the things that you might think would be the big hints that somebody would test positive here, you know, we have the advantage of we had about 750 people who tested negative, and we had about 250 people who tested positive, and we're able to look at the patient characteristics of the two. And there were a few really shocking things. One is if people were on 3 or more blood pressure medicines, in addition to the criteria of A1C greater than 7.5, plus, you know, a lot of diabetes medicines, that was more than a third of people tested positive, as an example. Another really funny thing was that it was actually the people who had a BMI less than 30 were more likely to test positive than those that had a BMI greater than 30, almost as if, you know, hypercortisolism is a risk factor for obesity. But in fact, if you have difficult to control diabetes and you're not obese, maybe it's hypercortisolism at the bottom. And the most powerful diabetes drug on the planet now is tirzepatide, you know, one of the GLP-1 receptor agonists, or actually a dual GLP-1 GIP receptor agonist. And people that were on that drug and still had an A1C of 7.5, in addition to being on other medications, they, in fact, that one subset of patients was the was the group that had the highest sort of relative risk of having hypercortisolism.
That's really fascinating. Wow. So it's almost like I kind of think of that as like maybe someone that's a non-responder to a GLP-1 or maybe just not having as pronounced of a response. It seems like potentially that could be a greater risk factor.
Right. I agree completely. The way I think it through basically is the harder you've tried and not been successful in getting the A1C less than 7.5, this hypercortisolism thing has to jump to like the top of the differential diagnosis. And whether that's treating their just their hyperglycemia with something like tirzepatide or semaglutide, or whether it's that you've really been pounding on their blood pressure medicines and you still have to get more, you know, if the harder you've tried and not been successful, I do think that's a signal you need to look for this hypercortisolism thing.
It's really, it's really interesting. And so the next phase is they're going to be randomized, I guess, to taking the mifepristone or not taking it. Is there also going to be like follow-up with imaging as well?
Yeah. And I'm glad you asked that question. So we did imaging as part of the program. So then the people that screened positive, they got an adrenal CT. This was a generic adrenal CT. This wasn't a dedicated study done in community centers. It hasn't been centrally adjudicated yet. About a third of patients had some finding in the adrenals. About a quarter had a solitary adrenal nodule. And the really interesting thing to this is the parallelism to the hyperaldosteronism story in resistant hypertension. So in that setting, it's about a third of people have an elevated or evidence of hyperaldosteronism, and it's about a quarter of those people have an adrenal nodule. And so it's a very parallel kind of paradigm that resistant diabetes, screening for hypercortisolism, you'll find a quarter of the patients with abnormalities in it, about a quarter of them will have a solitary nodule. And those people, it's really intriguing to think about the benefits of adrenalectomy. In the people who don't have adrenal abnormalities, you know, the mifepristone approach is one of a few that could be entertained.
So did any of the, I guess, the patients that were initially screened that were positive, did anyone get adrenalectomy?
I don't know. That part of the study is all blinded still. Okay. In our center, right. No. I just don't know.
Got it. Interesting. Wow. So I'm so curious. What do you, like, how do you think this affects clinical practice? Like, who, on a practical level, for the people listening, like, who should we screen? Like, should we start screening everyone with A1C over 7.5? Or should we, people that are on multiple blood pressure? Like, I'm just so curious your thoughts on this.
There's a couple of caveats. First is, you know, there were exclusion criteria in the trial, obviously not type 1 diabetes, obviously not people that have been sort of lightly treated. It's not that you couldn't screen them for the condition. It's just they're not sort of enriched for people who are likely to screen positive. And then there are things that will give you a false positive result on the dexamethasone suppression test. So night shift workers doesn't work because it's really based on the circadian rhythms. People with advanced chronic kidney disease, you know, particularly hemodialysis, but, you know, EGFR, much less than 30, the normal range gets expanded, at least with the standard cortisol assay. People with serious psychiatric illness, not people with sort of depression, but people with, you know, they're actively psychotic or incredibly stressed, sleep apnea, excessive alcohol use, and the use of oral contraceptive pills. There are ways to do the dexamethasone suppression test in patients like that, but you need a very special assay because of cortisol binding globulin sort of interfering with the whole process. But the way I would think about it is if you've made a good faith effort to help someone control their diabetes and or their hypertension in the setting of diabetes, and the patient has not done well, whether that's because you know, they've continued to develop complications. You've not been able to get the A1C less than 7.5. It's a simple test, as you said, 1 milligram of dexamethasone, 11 p.m., 8 o'clock in the morning. They get their blood drawn, both for the cortisol and for dexamethasone, to make sure that they actually took the drug. And if it's greater than 1.8, you're off to the races with a bit more of evaluation and consideration of the appropriate treatment strategy. Now, as far as changing guidelines, all we've shown is that we can find this, you know, this testing abnormality in people, but we haven't proven yet that we can make a difference by intervening based on that data. So I think for today, I wouldn't push hard on changing the guidelines. But if part two of this study is positive, this is going to change the world as we know it for the difficult to control patient with type 2 diabetes.
I also think that we need to start thinking about it differently. The idea of Cushing patients, people presenting with Cushing, is completely different than what you're telling us. You know, we don't look at BMIs less than 30 for someone with Cushing's. You say, well, they're not obese, clinically obese, right? So that person almost is ruled out automatically, right? That's not that presentation that we're, and I've never seen a patient present like the textbook. And I do have patients that have presented with Cushing's, you know, but it's always been, I've really leaned my clinical practice towards people who are obese. I mean, we really early on started looking at people who were, who couldn't, that those non-responders to GLP-1. But I don't know that any of us has, have really truly tied it all together. That hypertension, that you know, non-responders to those higher dose, very strong GLP-GIPs, you know, this really presents a very different looking patient than I think those that we've said, you know, let's screen this one now, right? Yeah. And it shouldn't be maybe one, it should be lots, you know, how many in my day should I be looking at to say, you know, is this someone that we should be looking at a little differently?
Yeah. And the one other thing I'll add is, you know, when I went to medical school, the screening test for Cushing syndrome was 24-hour urinary free cortisol. More recently, people have really embraced the late-night salivary cortisol. Those are good tests if you're looking for classic Cushing's disease, but these people, and sometimes it's called mild autonomous cortisol secretion or MAX, the cortisol secretion is mild. The consequences are not mild, this sort of more modest form of hypercortisolism or Cushing syndrome is clinically opaque. You just have to think of the possibility, and here we're asking people to think of the possibility in people with control diabetes, but you could make the same argument for people that have osteoporosis beyond what you think they really deserve, or you know, based on other risk factors, or people with difficult to control hypertension, et cetera, et cetera. So my guess is that thinking around this will be expanded as a result of this study to go beyond just the phenotype of difficult to control diabetes.
This is
incredible. I know we have to wait a while for the phase two results, but I'm just curious your thoughts, or maybe based on the mechanism of action of mifepristone, what you guys are kind of hypothesizing will occur in the group that is randomized to receive this drug.
Yeah. You know, we think they're like, you know, they're on stout diabetes medicines. They're on stout blood pressure medicines. We suspect that, you know, their hemoglobin A1C may improve, and that in patients on insulin, we may have to back off or even stop their insulin. It depends a bit on how much hypercortisolism they have. We suspect their blood pressure control might get better. I think most importantly, we suspect that they'll feel better. I mean, hypercortisolism gives you all kinds of unusual symptoms like fatigue, you know, muscle weakness, difficulty with sleep, et cetera, et cetera. So
this general malaise, this depression that they present with, this just like, yeah, this just, oh, that feeling of just they can't get through their day, you know? Right. And yeah.
And the other thing that has happened immediately when we tell people about this positive result, I remember one patient who was almost brought to tears. I mean, you could tell that she was just emotional because she, you know, she had tried hard with her diabetes care. And, you know, I'm sure there were doctors that gave her the, you know, the evil eye about, you know, I know you're not taking your medicine. Or, you know, family members would say, oh, you know, if you just did better with your diet. And now she found out she had, you know, she had a different problem. I mean, she had a problem that wasn't just a lack of willpower or taking the right medicines at the right time day after day. So it can be very encouraging, both for the diabetes care provider, but also for the patient and their families.
So it sounds like a lot of potential benefits. What is actually going to be the primary outcome of this phase two?
It's a change in hemoglobin A1C.
Okay. But hopefully you'll be measuring all these other secondary endpoints.
We are. Now, it's a relatively short intervention, around 6 months. So we won't, we'll be looking at bone mineral density and those sort of things. But, you know, certainly all the metabolic parameters, lipids, and the blood pressure, hemoglobin A1C, weight, that sort of thing. There's also some quality of life testing as well. We're probably underpowered for a lot of the things that we'll look at, but we'll get a sense of the spectrum of benefits.
I love this. This is incredible, right? I mean, this could be career game changing.
Right. And at the ADA meeting, you know, I've been around for a long time. I've been doing clinical trials in diabetes since the mid 1990s. And, you know, I've been involved in a lot of really amazing stuff in diabetes care over the last 30 years. But this might be the biggest thing that I have ever done in my career.
Wow. That is a big statement.
Yeah, but it all depends on part two. You know, if part two is a bust, you know, we'll have to think about it more. But I am cautiously optimistic that we're really onto something. And in my practice alone, you know, people that weren't eligible for the trial because we actually did manage to get their A1C less than 7.5%, but that had the other kind of criteria, we found several, you know, several patients. It's such an easy screening test, and it's one of those things that, you know, you would just hate to miss for many years, that we have been screening more just based on the experience in doing the trial and seeing the kind of patients that screen positive.
Wow. I can't wait for phase two. Do you know where that's going to end up being presented at? Any idea yet?
Well, you know, it's not etched in stone, but we've talked about presenting it at the American Diabetes Association meeting in June of 2025. The last patient, last visit will be near the end of this year. And, you know, if it's a blockbuster kind of result, because of sort of Security Exchange Commission kind of issues, it likely will initially be reported as a press release, but we'll see.
Awesome.
For sure, you'll know by the end of June of 2025.
All right. Well, I can't wait.
Which says what? Everyone needs to come to Chicago next year and join us at the ADA so that we can hear
this
live. Which
should be much cooler than Orlando. So no excuse not to come.
Right. But remember this year, it was actually hotter in Massachusetts than it was in Orlando, at least for the first few days of the meeting.
Yes.
Funny. Yeah, I think hotter in Cleveland, too. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Buse. This was so informative. We're so grateful for you to spend the time with us. And thank you so much to our listeners and viewers. And then that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue. We hope you'll join us again next time. Thank you.
Thank you.